Hello and welcome to our discussion on the recent Fear CEO letters from the FCA. My name is Elaine Tai and I'm your host for this afternoon's session. I'm delighted to welcome some of our leading experts from FSCOM here today. We have FSCOM's Managing Director, Jamie Cook, who leads up the investments team. Alison Donnelly, who's well known for her payments and e-money expertise. Phil Creed, who's the FinCrime expert. And Simon Whittaker, who leads up the cybersecurity consultancy. So the aim is that you leave today's session with some key takeaways and actions. And if you do, then we've achieved what we set out to do. So to start off, can we go round the house and ask each of you about your key areas of expertise and the key theme then arising for your relevant area of expertise from the recent Dear CEO letters, please? So Jamie, can we go to you first, please?
Hello everyone. As Elaine said, my name is Jamie Cook and I take the lead for FSCOM's investment firm team. I suppose that's a fairly broad remit. We advise on everything covering the Financial Services and Markets Act, but particular themes I suppose we're dealing with at the moment and advising upon are senior manager and certification regime, which will be no surprise. And obviously Brexit, with the upcoming potential deadline on the 31st of December. We're doing a lot of planning and authorisation work with firms looking to set up their European headquarters. I suppose, you know, from my perspective, just a couple of things in relation to some of the Dear CEO letters. I suppose in particular for wholesale brokers, they talked to TTCA and that was quite specific, but I think taking a step back, I think really what the FCA were talking to was around governance and accountability of the board and other relevant committees such as the Risk and Compliance and Audit Committee, and actually ensuring that they maintain proper and robust oversight. I think the other thing that probably jumped out to me was definitely around record keeping. I suppose in our experience, clients, you know, are very good at governance and are very good at putting in place procedures, but record keeping, I suppose, is essential to reflect what happens in operational practice, and particularly with a theme such as client assets and client money, it's probably absolutely critical that you make sure that the record keeping is accurate and kept up to date to ensure that in the event of failure, title for assets and recognition of client money is being held and stored appropriately.
Okay, Jamie, thanks for that. Alison, can we go to you next, please?
Hi, everybody. For me, the Dear CEO letter set out the agenda for the year ahead for payment and e-money institutions. And I know my colleagues, Phil and Simon, will speak to some of the other areas. But for me, the chunky changes that the Dear CEO letter brought out are things like, for instance, under safeguarding, there's a lot of refinements and areas that many of our clients will have already got in place. But one of the sort of big things from the safeguarding was the requirement to have an annual audit, and that lies on e-money institutions and some payment institutions. And I think that's that will be a big change for many of those firms. There's also a change in having to produce a wind down plan, and tied in with that, doing the stress testing on financials. So in my experience, firms will have done stress testing and thought about their financial forecasts at the application stage, and they will do it for their own business because that's just good business practice. But to do it in order to be able to show the regulator where they're going and how it's charting against expectations, and be ready to answer the questions in the FCA's fairly extensive financial resilience survey. I feel some firms haven't had that ready to hand in order to submit it, and actually that's caused a bit of stress for them to get prepared. Like Jamie's mentioning, governance and controls and record keeping was another area that was brought to the fore in the Dear CEO letter. And to me, I think it reflects a response from the FCA of saying, we have asked you if you're complying with this obligation and whether you're doing this, and you're telling us you're doing it, but but you haven't been able to produce the evidence. And then, of course, that's all going to throw an element of doubt as to whether the firm actually has done it. So as we always say, you know, if you haven't documented it, you haven't done it. So big reminder that everything needs to be documented.
Okay, Alison, thanks for that. From a financial crime point of view then, Phil?
Super, thanks Elaine. Yes, I'm Phil Creed, Director of Financial Crime at FSCOM. In terms of themes in regards to financial crime, certainly firms need to look more closely at the financial crime risks they're exposed to. The FCA have highlighted business-wide risk assessments, and I'd say that many firms do not actually have one. They also mentioned customer risk assessments are either inadequate or did not exist. Although not stated in the letter, I think in particular to customer assessments, I think this is particularly pertinent for individuals as the fast onboarding systems of a lot of fintechs, individuals are notoriously difficult to risk assess as there's not a large amount of open data when you compare that to like a limited company, for example. Third is a lack of EDD measures where a customer poses a higher risk or higher risk attributes. I think this can be quite typical for a number of firms because EDD measures can be hard to proceduralize as they really depend on the situation and why it has been high risk. But I think the issue that the FCA are alluding to that firms do not have a consistent approach, and it's clearly a big issue on their agenda. And finally, as agents, there seems to be a systematic issue in regards to senior management not having oversight of agents, particularly where they reside overseas. So it's clearly the FCA have been very clear that there's four clear points that they want firms to improve upon.
Brilliant. Thank you, Phil. And last but not least, Simon, from a cybersecurity side of things, can we move to you, please, and with regard to the recent key themes from the Dear CEO letter?
Absolutely. Thanks, Lane. Thanks, everyone else, for your wise words. For me, I think that there's a couple of very interesting sections within the letter. One of them, for particularly around for me, from a cybersecurity and IT perspective, is around governance and oversight. So the phrase that they say is many firms, we have observed that many firms do not review their regulated processes sufficiently frequently to ensure they remain compliant. They top that up with later on by saying, where we identify weaknesses, we will take action to ensure that firms meet the requirements. So what they're doing there is they're basically, this is a warning letter to people to say, you know, you may have put this stuff down on, you know, in a document 3 years ago, but does that still relate to how your firm looks now? And if it doesn't, then we need to know, and we will know, we will find out, and we will instigate measures to make sure that things become more compliant. I think as well that there's a very big risk from around IT resilience and cyber risks, which I think I'll maybe touch on a little bit later, but. Having appropriate systems and controls in place is absolutely vital, not only for yourself, but also for your intra-group operations and also with your suppliers. So it's not just the case that you can say, oh no, that other part of our company takes care of that for us. You need to make sure that as a firm that you have those measures cemented down and in place. And making sure that you have appropriate contingency plans as well. So you've got to make sure that your risk management procedures, as Phil said, are in place, but also make sure that from an IT resilience and cyber risk perspective, that you have those procedures in place. And if your third parties are compromised, then what does that mean for you? And I think that's an action that you really should be considering at this point.
Brilliant, Simon. Thanks for that. Okay, so delving deeper then into the recent Dear CEO letters, we know consumer protection and protection of client money is one of the FCA's strategic objectives, and it's always been a supervisory priority. But I suppose, Jamie and Alison, this is really for yourselves. What are the regulators' expectations of firms in this respect? Jamie, we'll go to you first, please.
Thanks, Elaine. Consumer protection and client money have long been sort of cross-sector priorities. And maybe I can speak, obviously, to our experience of advising firms, investment firms in this area. And keen to hear Alison's thoughts as to how that crosses across into this repayment services and e-money sector. But I mean, consumer protection might sound flippant, but for me, it's always a common sense approach. I mean, the FCA quite clearly want financial services firms through the financial promotion rules to ensure that any advertisement in relation to products is clear, fair, and not misleading. And you know, again, expectations would be that where you're providing examples on a performance of an investment product, you're providing sufficient detail, you're giving sufficient priority not only to the benefits but equally to the risks and the downsides of that investment product as well, making clear that any sort of form of capital that you may invest in investment product could be at risk without any protection in place. So I mean, for me, that's really what they're driving at. And I don't think financial promotion rules are particularly difficult for firms to comply with, but what it does require is it requires a process to ensure that there is control of any financial promotion literature that the firm issues. And again, we have done a number of projects and exercises with clients where we have reviewed and updated and enhanced financial promotion literature, and that also ensures sort of putting a procedure in place so that any promotional material goes through an approval process and has a register. I think with regards to client money, I mean, I suppose it's a bit simple to say, but it is our expectation that client money and also assets that are held by a custodian are safe in the event of firm failure, and fundamentally can obviously be redistributed to clients. And that is done in terms of a first priority rather than any sort of other creditors in the event of insolvency exercise. I think as well, when it comes to client money, you know, the FCA are increasingly expecting firms to sort of mitigate the risk of failure, and that's through robust risk management. So we've seen a lot of commentary from the FCA since March around firms ensuring that they're doing appropriate stress testing on capital to ensure that they have sufficient capital to allow for an orderly wind down. And Alison talked earlier just about the focus that she's seen in the payment and e-money sector on wind down planning, and I think that's probably be extended across the whole financial services market. I think the other thing is, you know, around liquidity risk management as well, so ensuring that the firm has sufficient cash resources, and again stress testing the liquidity positions and thinking as well about, you know, groups, and we would deal with a lot of multinational financial institutions that form part of a group, and the FCA have been clear as well in recent months just about mitigating any risk of sort of group contagion from a liquidity perspective. So I think that's a very quick overview of what their expectations are. I think a final point, I suppose, I haven't seen any letdown in their view and in their sort of requirements around client money or consumer protection as a result of COVID. And even if you look to the note to CAS issues on the 6th of April this year, they still require the CAS audit to be conducted within the requisite timescales. So there's no easing of the requirements to protect consumers and also to protect client money. But clearly they're cognizant of the challenges at the moment, and what they are reinforcing is the need for early notification where risks become critical and could potentially impact those particular areas.
Okay, Jamie, thanks.
Jumping in, so keen. the themes are the same here for investment firms as they are for payment and e-money institutions. And I think, you know, when we were talking at the beginning of the year as a regulatory outlook, we could easily have picked out that financial promotions were clearly on the agenda for e-money and payment institutions. The principles for business had been brought in and applied to them from last summer. That there was always a concern about consumer confusion. I think it's slightly more heightened now, even to the extent of with the fifth money laundering directive registration requirement for crypto firms. So what we've seen is there's a lot of firms, the FCA has really challenged firms that are e-money or payment institutions which have a crypto element, because they want to make sure that the consumer is not confused as to which is the regulated service and which isn't, you know, and so firms are having to address that point. And that can go wider because, of course, a lot of firms will do other activities such as the deliverable FX, and just making sure that that's communicated clearly. I think from the pandemic lockdown, what we see is a much greater focus on the prudential side for payment and e-money institutions. And of course, that has related and transferred into safeguarding guidance, but also this real commitment and expectation that firms should actually be stress testing and understanding what is happening in their forecasts. Where that brings interest is that the payment supervision team in the FCA has been expanded in the last few months to incorporate a rapid response team, and that model, that team have been asking questions about regulatory returns. And I think it's been a long held view over the last number of years that, you know, regulatory returns have gone into the FCA and there hasn't really been much scrutiny of them. That's changing now for payment and e-money institutions, and we're seeing clients who are being challenged to ask questions, you know, why have you calculated it this way, you know, and they found mistakes, you know, there have been mistakes identified. The firms will have to come back and redo and get it put in correctly. That model, that rapid response team model, I think is going to be or will be expanded across the FCA so that every sector has got a rapid response team. And I think that really emphasises the FCA's understanding and concern in terms of what the economic recession will bring to the financial services sector at a time when it's also having to deal with Brexit and the implications of what this is, yeah, so almost unknown implications in terms of business there. So the sort of all that to say that, you know, there's a concern about consumer protection in terms of what the consumer understands, but actually just the pure bones of the financial protection.
Okay, Alison, thanks for that. Moving on now to financial crime. Phil, you spoke earlier about obviously combating and preventing financial crime is a key cross-sector priority for the FCA. And from a financial crime perspective, what does the recent communications from the FCA mean for regulated firms?
I think, you know, all the communications and actually the behaviour of the FCA, there's been a real shift in the FCA's mindset from a slightly more passive regulator to a definitely a more active regulator whenever it comes to financial crime. The FCA did a thematic review towards the end of last year and followed up with a number of firms, and subsequently we've seen a number of releases like this. So I think it's a real statement of intent. I've actually seen, working with a number of firms, that the FCA is no longer accepting sort of growing pains or some other issues. You know, the FCA previously may have come up with issues, but if the firm had a good sort of plan of action to remediate these, the FCA would be sort of have a good ear to that. Now, what I've seen over the last 6 months, and it's got nothing to do with COVID, but particularly I just think it's the FCA's intent here, is that that is no longer good enough. You know, my feeling is that, you know, the payment services directive's been in for over 10 years, e-money's the same, and they're expecting a level of maturity of firms in these sectors now that It is no longer acceptable to say, oh, we will fix that, or we are employing someone, or we are moving forward. In my opinion, the FCA is clearly stating this is a regulatory obligation. And from my experience over the last year, that they're not shy in using some of the enforcement options that are open to them if firms are not compliant.
Okay, Phil, thank you for that. Simon, then moving on to the cybersecurity side of things, during an audit or application to the FCA, what are the areas that you find keep raising their heads from a cyber and IT perspective?
Thanks, Elaine. So yes, we do a lot of IT audits of organisations at the moment, and it always proves to be really interesting to see how firms are actually implementing the things that they say they do, to get a real look at the how the sausages are made, as it were. Sometimes it's less pretty than you would hope. The things that we tend to see from people are that there's an IT strategy document, but it's 10 years old, 5 years old, something like that. You know, it hasn't been looked at recently. It hasn't been looked at with a view for understanding what current risks are to the firm. And that is absolutely vital. It's a key part of all the documentation that we audit against and that we all work towards. Understanding that strategy and understanding that the strategy needs to be risk-based from the risks that apply to you. We also see business impact assessments being, you know, either filled in and saying all our software is vital to us, or you know, if you know, that everything is important to us, and that's pretty much it. That's just not good enough. That's a really important area to be aware of. You know, your business impact assessment should be the items that are critical to you as a business to keep on going. What can you deal with a bit of disruption on, and what can't you? It's very different if your entire infrastructure up in AWS gets compromised compared to if, for instance, you know, you can't access your CRM system for a day, for instance. You know, there's a different measure, and it's important to have that impact and that impact assessment. Phil's mentioned about risk assessment earlier on as well, and that's an area in which we frequently see people needing to spend a lot more time, and I think that's an area where we'll start to see the FCA really start to crack down in a similar way to some of the other regulators. A risk assessment shouldn't just be six risks: can't get into the office, systems are down, or laptop gets stolen. You know, that's not enough. We need to be really thinking about what are actual real risks to our organization, to our firms. And that's what we've got to, that's a really important area to be thinking about. Another area I think that is definitely worth mentioning is around business continuity planning and how business continuity planning is done. The amount of firms we've been into where we ask them for evidence of their continuity plan, unfortunately they've either not got one, or the last time they tested something, it didn't work, and it was 2 years ago. So in that 2 year period, they haven't learned anything about how to recover from threats, from issues. They haven't learned anything about how the organization should recover from problems. And that's really, really important. This is frequently a case of when something goes wrong, not if something goes wrong. And that's something that a lot of firms are struggling with. So definitely thinking about business continuity planning. Cybersecurity training and awareness is another large one. We actually were working with somebody very recently, and one of the application forms, there was no evidence to show that people had taken cybersecurity, the firm had taken cybersecurity training and awareness programs seriously. And for that, they wanted to see signature evidence that people had shown up to training. They wanted to see that people were definitely doing this. It's not just enough to show up at a little, to a webinar and listen. You actually have to evidence the fact. It goes back to what Alison was saying earlier. If you haven't documented this, you haven't done it, essentially. And I think that's getting more and more important now. And the final area just is around security and penetration testing. The fact that critical systems are supposed to be penetration tested on an annual basis. If you show up for an audit with a security test that was done 18 months to 2 years ago, This world changes very fast. The infrastructure changes fast. The code changes fast. If you're still relying on something from 18 months ago, then to be fair, you're probably doing it wrong. So I think that's a really important thing to bear in mind as well.
Okay, Simon, thank you for that. A lot to think about there on the cybersecurity side and things and what the FCA expectations are in relation to that. Other key areas of focus for the regulator this year obviously has been governance and culture. And again, this one for Jamie and Alison, starting with Jamie, how has then this impacted payments and investments firms on a practical level? So how has it impacted investments firms, Jamie, governance and culture?
I think the FCA talk about sort of four pillars to a healthy culture: purpose, leadership, governance and remuneration. And I think through those pillars, they implement rules and guidance and initiatives that I think has that practical implication for firms, because also they have to comply with it. And you know, in the past year, I think you'll have seen, or in the past number of years, you've seen with, you know, the implementation of the senior manager and certification regime in the UK, which, you know, was applied since 2016 for larger institutions, and then obviously kicked in last year for core firms. And you know, with the upcoming deadline or of the 31st of March for the certification. So that's the sort of practical implementations. Other areas where you see sort of firms having to comply is around remuneration. So, you know, capital requirement regulations stipulate core things with regards to remuneration principles. And I think maybe a nod to the fact that, you know, remuneration and by extension culture is not going anywhere is that, you know, the UK is committed to implement the investment firm regulations and directive next year, irrespective of what happens with regards to Brexit. And a big component of that legislation is around remuneration and ensuring that firms have balanced scorecards, they have clawbacks for variable remuneration, they have sort of the right balance between fixed and variable remuneration as well, which all speaks to sort of promoting good behaviour and speaks to ensuring that they're acting in the customer's best interest, which is a culture clearly that the FCA want to encourage. And I think, you know, increasingly as well, we're also seeing just greater accountability. So if we think about governance and think about, well, how does governance drive good culture? Well, there's far more accountability through initiatives such as SMCR. So we've now got conduct rules that crosses not just boards, but crosses senior managers and wider employees. You have far greater sort of scrutiny and enforcement action against individuals where they don't act appropriately as well. And I think the other thing that we have seen through authorisations, through I think the course of this year with regards to investment firms, is a lot more focus from the FCA on governance. So tell us really what these committees are doing. And if you're outsourcing, who is maintaining oversight of those functions that are being outsourced? And what are the responsibilities of each sort of committee within that governance structure? And a real focus around internal controls as well. So making sure that you have the appropriate sort of three lines of defence framework and there's sufficient clarity around that.
Great, Jamie. Alison, have you anything to add that on that from a payments firm's perspective?
So Jamie's rightfully talking about the senior managers regime, and that's been implemented for business firms, but not for payment and e-money institutions. So that leaves a bit of a gap, doesn't it? Because the whole emphasis and point here is that that regime comes in to hold senior executives to account. Just because the regime hasn't been implemented doesn't mean that that's not what the regulator expects for payment and e-money institutions. And one of the things that I think is interesting from the Brexit experience is that firms here in the UK who've been getting their authorisations elsewhere, we're seeing the intensity of the scrutiny of other regulators. And this is causing firms to have to sort of, from the ground up, build their compliance framework. Which they haven't possibly been able to go without in the UK. And so to the point that year after year, we've been getting communications from the FCA on things like safeguarding, and now we add to communication to consumers, and now we add to the list on prudential and other matters. And with my point earlier about the rapid response team and the uplift in supervision, I think this is going in a direction. Now, it may go slowly, but the interesting thing is last year, when there was a Dear CEO letter at the summertime, it came with an attestation, and firms were asked to personally sign and say, look, we've done this, we've checked, we're compliant. And so, you know, all the firms did that. This year, there isn't an attestation. So why is that? But there is a requirement to have an audit for some firms. And I think that's because, you know, the attestation process has been found to be a little bit weak in this situation. And so I would fully expect that the FCA will be a lot more intensive in their scrutiny this time round. Now, it's a long list of payment and e-money institutions, and it may take a long time to get there. But in this process, we would expect firms to have figured out from the Dear CEO letter what their roadmap to compliance is. And every firm will, you know, board will question, you know, the prioritisation, but you have to have some kind of level of prioritisation and work out which areas you're going to tackle first. And I think that speaks to the governance and culture of a firm, that those decisions are taken at the top.
Okay, Alison, just picking up then on the safeguarding side of things, do you think it's realistic of the FCA to expect boards of payments and e-money institutions to carry out a review of their safeguarding partners' trustworthiness when there are so few to choose from in the first place?
Yes. Okay. So I think it's realistic for the FCA to expect the boards to consider the risks involved with the partners that they partner with. Now, it may well be the case that it's almost a meaningless assessment because of the choice, the limited range of options. But that's no excuse for not understanding what the risks are in your business. And so there's absolutely, you know, there's no question about it. Boards need to understand they've chosen to go with so-and-so. These are the risks around it. This is a good decision or a bad decision, or the best we can do in the circumstances situation. And here's how we could make it better. And there is no doubt that in that discussion, you will improve your systems because you've recognised what the real genuine risks are.
Okay, thank you. Another question around their expectations then. They now expect all reconciliation procedures and rationale to be documented. Do you think that's fair expectation as well of PIs and EMIs?
Again, yeah, because we go back to the point, if it's not documented, then it never happens. And the point about getting the rationale together is something that, you know, we've been telling clients to do for a long, long time, and has really borne out in the super capital case, because there the liquidators were able to go in, understand what this, or should have been able to understand where all the flows of funds were, and you know, who was doing what and why, and that helps to form the judge and inform the judge's decision about the funds being returned to the consumers above all other creditors, and you know, that's really important for the consumer protection. So yes, documentation.
Okay, and Alison, finally, before I move on to the others, I know you've already spoke about this, but how proactive do you really think the FCA are going to be in checking up on whether they're meeting expectations this time, whether payment and e-money institutions are meeting their expectations?
Yeah, so history tells us that you know, it's going to be a long, slow process. I think there is very definitely greater resource being channeled into the supervision team. They're much more proactive, you know, as part of my role with the Emerging Payments Association as the project lead. We had, at first, we had fortnightly meetings with the FCA during the pandemic. Now that's eased to quarterly, but you know, that's new. That's a new interest in trade associations and what's happening in the sector broadly. I think the very recent situations with a variety of firms that have been had voluntary requirements put on them, or enforced requirements and stipulations put onto them, makes them very aware that they need to understand what's happening in the broader sector, and they're looking for advice. So all that to say, I think that there will be a process of going back and following up. Certainly lots of our clients have already experienced that. There is more information requirements and requests coming. It's a long process, but we think it'll come.
Okay, Alison, thank you. Phil, back to yourself. Phil, in your experience, then, what have you found are the recent challenges under the fifth Money Laundering Directive for financial services businesses?
Well, to be honest, it's primarily driven towards crypto asset exchanges and them having to register with the FCA under their AML obligations. So I suppose the challenge here is that the FCA is only regulating these firms for AML. And I suppose historically, quite a lot of these crypto asset exchanges would have implemented AML controls just for good practice. Cryptocurrency firms wanted to be seen to be doing the right thing voluntarily. So a lot of them would have done it already. The challenge for the ones that have done is actually the financial crime frameworks that they have put in place is actually, can they stand up to regulatory scrutiny whenever they go through the authorization process? Because it's all well and good doing it on a voluntary basis, but sometimes you need that stick to make sure you do cross the T's and dot the I's. For other firms that didn't actually do it voluntarily, they have to build it from scratch, which is a real challenge. And I suppose one of the reasons why we did the FinTech Starter Pack, Elaine, if you remember, like a year or two ago, was to help these firms who almost didn't know where to start and give them like some good solid foundations to build from. That being said, like a good financial crime framework develops. It's not something that you do and you leave sitting. It develops like everything else. I can see Alison smiling there. Everything needs to develop and needs to evolve. So those are the main challenges for these firms.
Okay, I'll jump on to another question there on virtual currencies. You probably touched on it, but what are the risks and regulations for virtual currencies, Phil?
Oh, okay. So there are, you've kind of hit my bugbear here, Elaine. There are real risks involved with virtual currencies. There's no doubt about that. You know, they've been about since 2008, 2009. They have been used as a vehicle to exchange all sorts of dark activities, dark web activities, drugs, whatever you name it. I'm not going to name them all, right? However, virtual currencies are built on a blockchain, which fundamentally is an open ledger. Okay, so what that means is every transaction that goes through these blockchains are there forever. Okay, so they cannot be deleted, and they are there forever. What we've seen in the last 5 or 6 years is firms like Chainalysis come along and go, okay, well, I'm going to interrogate all this data and see what I can find. And what they find is they're able to track transactions of, I'll just say Bitcoin, for example, from whenever it was mined to wherever it is now. And if you can imagine that, if you imagine a 10-point note, you have no idea where a 10-point note has been. It could be in a drug dealer's wallet. It could be going to the shop to buy sweets. You know, you then get given it in your change. So this level of, or this ability to be able to view this is really, really new and actually has real potential in solving financial crime investigations. And I'll give you another example of that. In the Danske Bank scandal, there was thousands and thousands of entities, lots of them incorporated in the UK, that had bank accounts all over Europe, and they were transacting money through these bank accounts from Estonia to Sweden to Denmark to UK, back again, round and round. There's a diagram on it. It's crazy, right? But for law enforcement to investigate that, each one of those financial institutions, those funds went through, which all they really want to see is where did this money go next? Okay, that's what the law enforcement's looking for. They have to get production orders. They have to get legal production orders in each one of those jurisdictions to get that information. Okay, if that was done via cryptocurrency, and there are many limitations. I'm not going in that you can hide sometimes from cryptocurrencies your transactions and things like that, right? But in an ideal world, they could have plugged into chain analysis and seen all that interaction instantly. So to sum up, yes, there are real risks. There are people who try and hide their money on cryptocurrencies. I'm not denying that. But in terms of potential for financial investigators to catch money launderers, it's got huge potential. And it's something that I think, you know, I'm welcoming the fact that it's moving on. You've even got central banks all over Europe consulting right now about building their own digital currencies, their own centralized digital currencies, which is including the Bank of England, which is fascinating.
Exactly. Fascinating stuff there, Phil. Thank you for that. I'm going to jump back to Simon now. Simon, given the focus on cybersecurity and operational resilience from the FCA so far this year, what do you see as the risks coming down the track for financial services companies?
So I think there's a few different areas that will be of interest for financial services firms. And I think the first one is that the FCA will and are getting better technically. So previously there have been, you know, sometimes, should we say, you know, a technical document would be submitted and maybe it meets the right kind of quota of the right words in the right places, and, you know, it might be approved. We're starting to see that change now very much in the fact that the technical documents are being investigated, they're being looked at, they're being kind of joined together now, even so that we're being told, you know, we're kind of seeing that, you know, you've mentioned X in here, but it's not mentioned in your architecture diagram over here. Why is that the case? And those are really interesting things, because previously we would have seen a, you know, here's a architecture diagram, boom, there you go, that's it. But now there's a lot more information being provided and being investigated in a lot more detail. And that's really interesting. So, you know, the technical knowledge required from firms is going to be definitely higher, because the FCA knowledge is going to get better as well. I already mentioned about the requirement to prove compliance as well. So, you know, if it's not documented, it's not done. That goes down from everything from your security and penetration testing to your security awareness and training for yourselves and your suppliers and any other third parties that you're working with. So making sure that you're actually looking at those things, making sure that the scope of whatever you're doing is documented correctly. It's really, really useful to know. I think that what we're also going to see is that there will be more of these things starting to compromises starting to come out. We're going to see more data continuing to flow outwards from all sorts of organizations. And I think that what that'll lead to is that'll lead to enforcement actions, not just by, you know, the banking regulator, the financial services regulator, the financial conduct authority, sorry. We're going to see a lot of those kind of joined up. So, you know, we'll see ICO involvement potentially in some cases where, you know, there's going to be linkages between these two enforcements, you know, and we've already seen from some of the intentions to fine from the ICO of Marriott and British Airways and things like that, who both experienced a cyber event, that they are being there's a very large intention to fine issued by the ICO. Which is probably going to be brought back, but we'll see what happens. I think there's also going to be an increased requirement to monitor data loss as well. I think that's going to be something. So instead of it being just, you know, somebody releases the information you know, eventually it gets written about, I think that it's going to need to be a proactive investigation of data loss. So data loss systems, I think, are going to be really useful to, you know, there can be a big boom in that sort of world. The other thing I think around the things coming down the track, I've already mentioned about third party providers and suppliers. One of the things I would say is that we're starting to see an awful lot of people, an awful lot of firms, especially fintech world, moving towards the cloud, this magic cloud that exists above and around and inside all of us. But actually, cloud does not equal secure. Cloud is not the same as secure. How you implement cloud infrastructure makes it secure. So I think we're going to start seeing a lot more questions being asked around that and about how you're implementing your third parties and your cloud providers. In fact, actually, we had a question from one of the regulators just the other day, which asked us to list all of the services we were using in AWS and how they were being secured. That's quite a lot of detail. That's a big amount of information needing to be required. So I think that's going to be a very interesting area. And finally, I think that we're starting to see that the FCA are asking for support from some of the big tech firms. So they've asked earlier this year, for assistance to help collaborate with the FCA around these items. And I think that will be really interesting and really useful to see. How will Google or Microsoft respond to those requests for collaboration? About data breaches or data loss. What are we going to see from that side of things? So I think that'll be a very interesting set of things to look out for over the course of the next year or so.
Fantastic, Simon. Thank you for that. And I've saved the last question for Jamie, and it's the Brexit question. It has to come up. So, Jamie, with the last round of scheduled Brexit talks prior to the UK government's October 15th deadline, what are the key risks for UK financial institutions?
No deal, in two words. If we keep going the way we're going and the challenges that we're having over fishing rights, then there's a real danger here that the 31st of December comes. COVID clearly hasn't helped the pace and the time for these discussions. Then ultimately, you go out on a no deal basis, and I think there are clearly significant implications then, because there'll be a loss of passporting rights throughout Europe. Now, it's well publicised, and a lot of firms have invested a lot of time and a lot of effort to obviously put contingency plans in place. And that is fundamentally to set up a second headquarters, which would be their European headquarters. And certainly we've been involved in helping a number of clients do that. But for those businesses who haven't, or those institutions who haven't completed that process yet, if the 31st comes with no deal, clearly there's going to be challenges around how they service their non-UK European-based clients. And that was a bit of a tongue twister, but now there are sort of rules called reverse solicitation, which would allow some continuity. But in my view, in our view, that largely would only extend to existing clients, and even in very limited circumstances. And I think the other challenge is going to be the political fallout, because if it goes out on a no deal and it goes out on bad terms, firms operating without full authorisation in other European jurisdictions could be subject to pretty heavy scrutiny because of the political fallout. And I suppose that's the most immediate sort of consequence. I think, thinking sort of medium to long term, there clearly could be divergences in how Europe and the UK approach regulation. Now, we are seeing broad equivalency in some on the legislation at the moment, but over time that could diverge. And if that diverges, then clearly you're going to have to, therefore, as an institution, think about how you address that, how you stay on top of two potentially very different sets of regulations. And that's fine for global businesses who are used to dealing with Australia, Asia, and the US. But for smaller institutions or medium-sized institutions, they would have to therefore then really think about the different sort of divergence in those regulations and how they comply with them. So there's clearly a lot on the line, and there's material and important risks. But for those firms who have adopted early contingency plans, they likely are already authorised and starting to mobilise with a view to then going live before the 31st in good time, and that's great. But I suppose we all need to wait till we find out what the position is mid-October.
Certainly will. Jamie, thanks so much. Alison, Phil and Simon, thanks so much for your participation today and for everybody else's attention. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for. But anybody that's asked any questions today, we will come back to you after the session. So thank you everyone for your attention, and to all the experts. And good afternoon. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Cheers.
Thanks, Elaine.
Thank you.